From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump's transition team is holding meetings with some high-profile people today. And Hillary Clinton gave her first speech since conceding the election last week. So let's check in with Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. He joins us on Skype. Matt, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first of all, Matt, the president-elect is meeting today with a number of high-profile people at Trump Tower in New York. Who are they and what roles could they potentially play in his administration?
Yeah, so some of them are sort of past officials. Henry Kissinger is one of the people he's meeting with. He's also meeting with Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, which is an interesting choice and some that people point to as a potential person in his administration. So it's sort of a mix of different folks that he's meeting with today and keeping a busy schedule. Tonight, he is having a meeting with Prime Minister Abe from Japan, one of his first face-to-face meetings with a foreign leader. It's a little bit of a delicate period. President Obama is overseas, you know, on his final foreign trip. So President-elect Trump is kind of seems to be conscious of the fact that he still has 2 months before he assumes office. So he's wanting to project some kind of statesmanship, but sort of not over-project it.
Well, let's back up here a bit, Matt, because you were talking about Nikki Haley as a name being floated for a cabinet position in the Trump administration. She didn't support him during the election.
Right. And that is something that raises a lot of eyebrows with this kind of a meeting. A lot of the people that Trump has been looking at to fill his administration are the kind of people who've been loyal to him. That's something that Donald Trump, sort of holds in highest regard. So it's, you know, kind of a watched meeting to see whether Trump can accept or talk to people who were not supportive of him, because there's been a lot of reports of other people calling in or trying to have an impact on the transition, and the Trump people completely rebuffing them, sort of citing sort of the old wounds of even the primary campaign.
Well, let's talk for a moment, if we can, about other names that are being floated here. There's, of course, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, whose name is being bandied about for attorney general. Now, he just recently proposed again a registry of immigrants that would include Muslims. So talk about that for a moment.
So, I mean, that is an indication of sort of the Steve Bannon part of Trump's orbit, sort of exerting some influence. Kobach has been seen as somebody who's a little bit on the fringes of the Republican Party, but now it's becoming much more mainstream. I mean, I think that's a real indication and an early sort of litmus test for where Donald Trump sees his administration going.
Well, finally, Matt, since we mentioned it in the introduction here, I do want to point out that Hillary Clinton did speak last night at the annual gala of the Children's Defense Fund. It's actually the place where she began her legal career. And here's a little bit of what she had to say.
There have been a few times this past week when all I wanted to do was just to curl up with a good book or our dogs and never leave the house again.
Clinton also did speak rather emotionally about her mother and, you know, acknowledging that she has had quite a powerful political career. And her message to people listening last night was, don't give up. But she also looked, I mean, she had a defeated look about her. Let's be perfectly honest about that. You know, what do you think is in her future?
It's hard to tell. I mean, the Clintons have had such a prominent role and a shadow, really, over the entire Democratic Party for decades. There's a lot of frustration within the party over how her campaign was run and that she did lose. So it's hard to sort of figure out. Maybe there's a cause or something that she can attach herself to, but. As she has said herself, it's going to be a long and painful process to sort of recover from such a defeat.
Well, Matt Visor is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow, federal judge Gonzalo Curiel will consider President-elect Donald Trump's request to delay a civil fraud trial concerning Trump's now defunct university. The class action suit claims that Trump University misled students when it promised to teach success in real estate. This week, the Trump legal team won a small victory. They will be allowed to show documents in which some students gave positive reviews of the school. But if Trump loses his appeal to put the trial off until after the inauguration, it could start start up the Monday after Thanksgiving. Curiel is the same judge Trump said was biased because he was a Mexican, when in fact Curiel is American and born in Indiana. And there are more twists to this story. Josh Gerstein is senior White House reporter at Politico. So, Josh, what are Trump's lawyers saying in trying to get this delayed?
Well, Trump's lawyers are saying that preparing for the presidency, this transition period is very compressed, about 70 days in all, and it's sort of all-consuming and critical for the country that Trump pay attention to those concerns and not necessarily to a civil fraud trial over a real estate seminar program that he ran or oversaw several years ago. They're trying to make sort of a good of the nation argument. They even go so far in their legal papers as to point out that Trump is a political novice, suggesting that, you know, the hurdle for him and the work he needs to do in the coming weeks may be even more critical than it would for someone with more political or governmental experience.
And we know the attorneys on the other side, those filing the class action suit, are saying that some of their plaintiffs are elderly and have medical issues. So even if Judge Curiel agrees to grant this request to delay the trial until after the inauguration, that does not mean that Donald Trump is off the hook. There is precedent for a sitting president to be tried. Remind us of that precedent, because ironies abound here.
Right. So the clear Supreme Court precedent on this issue comes from the sexual harassment lawsuit that Paula Jones, a former Arkansas state employee, filed against President Bill Clinton, alleging that back when he was governor, that he harassed her in a hotel suite in Little Rock. And that case did go all the way to the Supreme Court. President Clinton's lawyers made very similar arguments, that he was too busy with the duties of the presidency, that all kinds of ills would befall the nation if he were forced to face a trial in that case. And the Supreme Court basically didn't buy it. It was a unanimous decision and said that, no, there's no immunity for a president. A president is like any other citizen. And if, especially if they're being sued for something that happened before they took office, there's no just blanket rule that they either don't get tried in that case or that the case is automatically put off until after their term in office. The court just rejected that out of hand, essentially.
Well, in working on Paula Jones' legal team, pro bono, was George Conway III, a Republican lawyer who's married to Donald Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway. In fact, he wrote around that time in the Los Angeles Times an op-ed saying, in a case involving his private conduct, a president should be treated like any private citizen. The rule of law requires no more and no less. This is pretty ironic.
Yeah, it sure is. It's quite a role reversal. But this is something that we're seeing in Washington at the moment. A lot of arguments that were deployed on one side of the aisle are suddenly being flipped over and deployed on the other side of the aisle. I mean, we should make clear that both cases are just civil cases. They're not criminal cases. It's not even, legally speaking, required that the president-elect in this case, show up and sit there through the trial. It's not like that, but it's still quite a distraction. And Trump has already been deposed for a total of about 10 hours about this Trump University matter, videotaped depositions that he gave, about 7 hours of that done during the campaign trail. He had to duck out on two different occasions and be questioned by plaintiff's lawyers about the conduct of this Trump University program.
Well, and remind us again, just as we look back into history, the Paula Jones lawsuit was settled without any admission of guilt. But there were depositions given by then President Bill Clinton. And what happened with those depositions?
Well, I mean, it sort of set in motion his impeachment and that whole imbroglio of 2 years of basically crisis in Washington. It was during one of those depositions when President Bill Clinton was asked about relationships he might have had with other women in the work arena beyond Paula Jones. And the question came to people that were working in the White House, and the lawyers in that case, Paula Jones's lawyers, quite clearly knew that there had been a relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and they started asking him about it. And basically, he denied it in a way that appeared to some people to be lying or perjury, and said that it didn't happen, basically unleashing the wheels of the whole impeachment process.
So that's the past. Looking forward, Judge Curiel has encouraged both sides in the Trump University case to come to a settlement. Any sense that that might happen?
Well, there's clearly a tremendous incentive on Trump's side to settle at this point. He doesn't need the headache of this trial going on, either whether it takes place during the transition or the early months of his presidency. But, you know, it's a complicated situation. There are actually two federal class action lawsuits. There's also a state lawsuit in New York State brought by the New York State Attorney General. They'd probably all have to be settled together. And this trial is supposed to begin on November 28th, right after Thanksgiving. It does not leave a lot of time to hammer out a settlement. And frankly, there's very little reason for the people pursuing those cases to bargain very much with Trump at this point. I think they probably think they have him between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah. Well, and USA Today counts 75 ongoing cases in which Donald Trump is either a plaintiff or a defendant. So any sense, Josh, what Judge Curiel might decide tomorrow?
I think he's unlikely to delay the trial. He might make some accommodation for, say, videotape testimony or a closed circuit feed if Trump wants to testify at the trial. But this lawsuit has been pending for about 6.5 years now. To put the case off even for a matter of months, Curiel seems like he's not inclined to do that. He thinks the transition might be as good a time to do this as any. It's not clear Trump's duties will become any less pressing after he's sworn in on January 20th.
Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter at Politico. Josh, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
More than 360 businesses and investors have signed a letter calling for continued U.S. participation in the Paris Climate Accord. Major companies including Starbucks, Unilever, General Mills, Nike, DuPont, Mars Incorporated all signed on. And the call came at the UN climate negotiations in Marrakesh, Morocco, where global leaders are currently hammering out the details for implementing the pact. Joining us now from Marrakesh is Barry Parkin, Chief Sustainability Officer at Mars Incorporated, one of the largest food companies in the world. He's at the conference in Marrakesh. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me on, Meghna.
Well, first of all, America has chosen as its 45th president a man who has called climate change a hoax. From your perspective as the chief environment officer for one of the world's largest food companies, what is your reaction to that?
Well, this is about collective action. This is about getting all governments, all companies moving in the same direction. It's an incredible challenge to try and constrain the warming of the planet to no more than 2 degrees. So the more people pulling in the same direction, the better. And, that's what the Paris Accord was about, around getting, 200 countries to line up and all move in the same direction. So, of course, we're keen that every country follows through on that, and the U.S. is no exception. So, we willingly joined that coalition of companies, 360 companies, to sign that letter. Of course, we'd like the U.S. to continue on the path that they've committed to.
Now, how has Mars Inc. changed, or how will it change how it does business in anticipation of the Paris Climate Agreement?
We'd recognize that climate change was real and urgent back in 2009 when we made our first commitments to reducing our carbon footprint. And we committed to a set of commitments that were in line with the science so that we did our part to not warm the planet by more than 2 degrees. And we've progressed down that path. So we committed to a 25% reduction in our greenhouse gas from our operations by 2015. We hit that, and we're on path to the next milestone, a 40% reduction by 2020, and then zero carbon by 2040. So, we're exactly on the path that we need to be on, exactly on the path we committed to. So this is just a long-term march towards a low-carbon economy, and we're doing that through efficiency and renewable projects. We launched a major wind farm in the U.S. last year in West Texas, 118 wind turbines, and that at one stroke covered the electricity needs of all of our U.S. factories. So we went to 100% renewable for all of those factories. We followed that this year, the beginning of this year, with a similar activity in the U.K. Again, 100% renewable in the U.K. now. And we've just announced last week a wind project in Mexico, which does the same thing. So, we're just marching through those 40 countries. The next ones we're looking at, China, India. So global activity that has to be executed locally.
Huh. Interesting. Now, there does seem to be, amongst many businesses, this burgeoning sense that for long-term stability for the companies themselves, that moving towards cleaner energy is an imperative. So is there enough momentum in the business community for cutting greenhouse gas emissions that in and of itself could mitigate any effects of, if the U.S. does, as a nation, pulls out of the Paris Climate Agreement?
Yeah, no, I think the word momentum is a good one. I think there is a significant momentum now, both with countries and corporations. And the reason there's that momentum is that this is now a great business case. You know, we've reached that tipping point where in many places, renewable energy is more cost effective than fossil fuels. So there's just a great business case to be getting on with this. And many companies have now recognized that.
Now, of course, Mars is a major global company, owns tons of brand names, including Uncle Ben's, which gets its rice from India. And I wanted to ask you about that because one of the major questions at the UN climate conferences is how developing nations are going to fund their reductions in greenhouse gases and make the transition to clean energy. Now, President Barack Obama has committed $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund, which would be set up to help developing nations do just that. But say President-elect Trump ultimately either pulls the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords or decides to not fund that $3 billion commitment, could that have an effect on developing nations and therefore companies like Mars that have a lot of businesses there?
So first of all, we source rice from all over the world, and actually a huge amount of rice from the U.S., some from India for sure, for the speciality rices. No, but I think your point of, you know, how are the developing countries going to manage along this transition? Well, it's going to be through a combination of public funding and private funding. And in fact, the private funding will vastly outweigh the public funding. So it's through corporations like Mars and others who are investing in sustainable agriculture all over the world. So, you know, it's in our interests that the farmers in India who are producing rice or any other material are successful, because that's the only way we guarantee a stable and quality supply of raw materials into our business. So we are investing, we have been, and we will continue to invest heavily in developing agriculture in the developing world. And that, in fact, I think will be the lion's share of investment to solve this. And we have activities all over the world working with smallholder farmers today, and we're going to be investing even more into the future to help them get ready for climate change and to mitigate climate change.
Well, Barry Parkin is the Chief Sustainability Officer at Mars Incorporated. He's speaking to us from the UN Climate Conference in Marrakesh, Morocco. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.
President-elect Trump takes over the White House in January, which means President Obama still has a couple of months to make some key environmental decisions. One open question is offshore oil and gas leasing. The Interior Department has already removed waters in the Atlantic Ocean from consideration for the next 5 years. Now, environmentalists want the White House to place the Arctic Ocean off limits. The oil industry is lobbying to keep it open, and a decision is expected any day. And as Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska Energy Desk reports, if Obama bans offshore drilling, it might not be so easy for the Trump administration to undo it.
If you've been in Washington, D.C. this fall, you might have seen this ad promoting offshore oil and gas drilling.
You know, the decisions that we make today will benefit our children's grandchildren for generations.
Tell Washington to support Native Alaskans. Include the Arctic in the next offshore leasing program.
That ad is part of a campaign by a coalition of industry, labor, and some Alaska Native groups. At stake is the Department of the Interior's 5-year plan for offshore oil and gas leasing, which will determine what areas off Alaska's Arctic coast are made available to industry through 2022. Lucas Francis is with the Arctic Energy Center, which has been pushing to keep the Arctic open for drilling.
It's not final until it's out there in the public record in the Federal Register. And we want them to understand what's at stake for Alaskans and what's at stake for domestic energy production.
Right now, companies aren't exactly clamoring to drill in the Arctic Ocean. The drop in oil prices have made the expensive and risky region less appealing. And ever since Shell announced it was abandoning its high-profile exploration effort last year, many companies have given up the leases they already held. But Francis says just because there isn't interest now doesn't mean there won't be in the future. And once the leases are removed, he says, it's harder to put them back in, and companies are less likely to include the Arctic in their plans.
The opportunity to invest needs to happen now for development to happen in 10, 15, 20, or even 25 years from now. If you don't have the opportunity to even pursue an exploration, if you don't have a lease sale, you do not have those investments.
If the Obama administration does remove the lease sales, a Trump administration could always rewrite the plan. But that would require going through much of the public process all over again.
And that does take time. So you're looking at potentially a year and a half to 2 years to make any revisions to a new plan.
And national environmental groups are betting on that not being a top priority for the new administration. Neil Lawrence is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It makes no sense at all to do offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean.
Lawrence says Shell's experience proved that Arctic drilling costs too much and comes with too many unknowns. He argues that companies haven't proved they can prevent or clean up a major oil spill in the region. And he says by the time that oil starts to flow, it'll be too late.
By the time that oil flows, we're going to have to be in a world that is using far less fossil fuel. Over time, we're either going to ramp way down on fossil fuels or we are going to cook the planet.
Lawrence and others would like to see the Obama administration go even further, permanently removing the Arctic from oil and gas leasing under a special provision of law. Emily Yaley is a reporter for E&E News in D.C. She says that move would likely make it even harder for a Trump administration to undo.
The Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act does not specifically give any future presidents the authority to end that withdrawal. So they think that it would be permanent.
An announcement on the offshore leasing plan is expected this week. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
And we've got this update on a story we've been covering. The long-running drought in much of the northeastern United States is expected to continue into the winter. The U.S. Drought Monitor map released today shows dry conditions continuing through February across New England. Parts of upstate New York, though, may see some relief and rain. The drought has devastated farmers in the region. It's dried up wells and dropped water levels in lakes. And drought in much of the southeast, the southwest, and parts of the Midwest and California are all expected to continue.
And there's a poignant drama unfolding in the NFL. 36-year-old Tony Romo, star quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys, made an emotional speech earlier this week, acknowledging that it's time to step aside for the talented 23-year-old rookie, Dak Prescott.
What is clear is that I was that kid once. Stepping in, having to prove yourself. I remember the feeling like it was yesterday. It really is an incredible time in your life.
Romo's battled a back injury all year. Prescott's been leading the team toward the playoffs with an 8-1 start. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, has some thoughts. And, you know, not everyone's been following this story, Mike, so catch us up on just how good Tony Romo's been.
Right. So Tony Romo's a great quarterback, often injured, and that seems like a slight on him. The other way to look at it is no one battles through really, really I don't want to say crippling because that's not that's a real thing in the NFL. But, you know, seriously debilitating injuries more than Tony Romo. But he just can't seem to get past like breaking vertebrae in his back. The Cowboys came into the year as a team sitting on the potential to have a great offense if Tony Romo was healthy. And then he got hurt. So people looked at his backup, Dak Prescott, and said, well, I guess there goes the Cowboys season. But Prescott has been great. Mm-hmm. And as a result, now that Tony Romo is ready to play, there is going to be the inevitable. Who will get the job? The job at the helm of America's team. And Romo stepped aside graciously. He had to. The writing was on the wall. He's 36. You know, Prescott's a guy in his early 20s. But I have to say, if you don't think that that tone and those words are as important as picking up a blitz or hitting a receiver over the middle, you're crazy, because the cohesion in a locker room, as dictated by the quarterback, or in this case, the ex-quarterback, is extremely important and will be vital for the Cowboys' success.
Well, he said he felt guilty about letting his team down, but acknowledged that his time had passed. Age caught up with him. Let's listen to a little more.
I feel like we all have two battles or two enemies going on. One with the man across from you. The second is with the man inside of you. I think once you control the one inside of you, the one across from you really doesn't matter.
Yeah, you know, the battle, the game doesn't really matter. But what about, you know, young Dak? I mean, that's a lot of pressure on him now.
He's a poised guy. Not only did he take that speech well, and by the way, just hearing that in isolation, let's acknowledge it can seem overwrought. This is a football game, and I timed the speech, and it was about 800 words, and Hillary Clinton's concession speech was about 1,100 words, so they were actually close if you compare concession speeches. But Dak Prescott, part of his great ability is not just the athleticism and his throwing ability. He's poised, and not only does he handle this situation right, he has volatile personalities around him, like his receiver Dez Bryant. He handles that race, handling everything right. And the Cowboys are on their way to what could be a phenomenal season.
Well, and by the way, to his words, to Romo's words, anybody, you know, anybody can take those. You know, it's the person inside you, not the one who forget about the competition. But just very, very briefly, Mike, boy, the NFL's got bad ratings. This might come at a great time with Dak Prescott being heroic or not.
Yes, because the Cowboys are the biggest draw. Their game against the Steelers was the most watched game of the season last week. And even though ratings are down, they might rebound after the election, but the NFL is going to ride the story of the Cowboys like a cowboy rides a horse.
Yeah. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
For almost her entire adult life, Diana Ploss was a Massachusetts Democrat. But back in 2013, things started changing for Diana. She felt the country wasn't moving in the right direction, so she registered as a Republican. She later quit her job and volunteered full-time for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. I spoke with Diana Ploss yesterday, a week after Donald Trump became president-elect, and she began by telling me how she felt after Trump won the White House.
I think it was a couple of days after the election because I was so tired working on it. I did kind of like yes, okay? But my yes was more like for America, like a sigh of relief. I don't feel smug. I don't feel like, ugh, we beat the other side. Uh-huh. That's never how I thought. Now, I feel like America was on a cliff. I feel like we're pulled back a little bit. We can regroup. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. This is not a time to gloat. This is a time to, we're a team.
But you know that there are a lot of people right now who are feeling like they are not part of the team because they're frightened and they're worried and they're scared about what a Trump administration means to them personally in their lives. I'm thinking about people of color, the LGBT community, immigrants. What would you say to them?
Well, the thing is, for some reason, it seemed like polls weren't feeling the pulse of what was really happening with people who supported Trump. And I think it came as a shock to people who were reading. If you just read one part of media and you're listening to leaders, even Obama said Trump won't be president. This one said Trump won't be president. So, of course, it comes as a shock to people, right?
Well, I think people are feeling a sense of shock and concern because of what what he said during the election. But then there's also this. Just recently, the president-elect named Steve Bannon,
yes,
of Breitbart News, as his role is going to be as chief strategist for the White House. Now, Breitbart has been, you know, a major megaphone for white nationalists. That is one of the reasons that people point to, like, that's why they're concerned.
So what I would encourage people to do is to read about Mr. Bannon. I always take exception to whether somebody says, like, white nationalists. Like, what does that mean exactly? I don't know what that means, white nationalists. What is that? I don't understand what that means.
Well, I think it means there's a group of people out there who believe that America should be a white nation. They want the white race to be, you know, the privileged race in this country. It is about race.
Is that what Steve believes?
Well, he's done nothing to disavow the people who do say it explicitly.
I don't want the country to be all white. And I know many of the Trump supporters who aren't white don't want the country to be all white. Like Chinese Americans for Trump, huge group. Why did they come out for Trump? Yeah. The Haitian community.
So, Diana, those are all good questions, but let me just phrase it this way. And I also then want to get
but
to...
But Diana, I do want to answer your question.
Yeah, well, so go ahead.
Okay, so Trump supporters are not a group of white nationalists. We're a very varied group of people.
Yeah.
We're not monsters. We believe in America, and we believe in America first. What is so wrong with that?
I think the thing that people struggle with is, there was a writer who put it this way. One particular supporter of Mr. Trump may not be a white nationalist, but by saying that the things that Donald Trump said as a candidate and the choices he might make as president, which do hew closer to white nationalist thinking, by saying that that stuff doesn't bother them, that it makes it hard to say that they're not
supporting
inadvertently supporting.
Right, but how can you? How do you know who's going to follow you? You just can't, because what's the difference? Hillary Clinton had supported Black Lives Matter, and a lot of them have done not such good things.
While what you're saying, I think some people listening probably would object to it. I want to ask you about how President-elect Trump can lead. You know, because, for example, the Southern Poverty Law Center has already documented 200
I don't believe them.
I do.
I don't believe them.
You don't believe that the FBI has even said there's been a spike in hate crimes against Muslim
Americans. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a reputation of preying on people.
Do you disagree with the FBI saying that there's been a spike in hate crimes against Muslim Americans?
I'd have to look at the statistics. I haven't seen them. I mean, they might be new statistics for the last week. I don't buy it.
Come back to your analogy of America as a team. If we take, you know, President-elect Trump is now like, he's like the coach of the team. He's leading the team now. If the team feels so divided, what should the coach be saying? What should the leader of the team be saying to bring that team together?
He has come out and said that he wants people to stop that, and he was interviewed on 60 Minutes. Well, he's not the president yet. I feel like Obama has to be the leader. He's the leader right now. He is the leader. People look up to him. He's still the president. Obama needs to get out there, and he has to quell this stuff. Because who are they going to listen to? They're going to listen to Trump right now? Uh-uh.
Well, they're not. But the folks who voted for him would listen to the president-elect.
Yes, but I would argue with you, but not in an argumentative way.
You can. This is an open table.
Right, but that's not the problem. Believe me, I am not trying to minimize people. I'm not. But you have to take a step back. It is going to be okay. Yeah. It really is going to be okay. It is.
So one more question about Washington. So you mentioned about draining the swamp, as Donald Trump said he'd like to do when he was a candidate for the White House. There seems to be some debate as to whether or not that's actually happening, right? Because just today in the Boston Globe, there was a big article about how lobbyists, in fact, may be more excited than ever about their opportunities in Washington now because there will be a Republican in the White House and in the Senate and the House of Representatives. This could be the gravy train for lobbyists. Does that concern you?
It doesn't. You know what concerns me more is that people write stories like that.
The Globe was quoting actual lobbyists who were saying this.
Right. But what I'm saying is just because that's what they're saying and that's what they're hoping doesn't make it a fact. There are so many intertwinings, connections of people. That's the swamp. There's so many people tied into one another. And okay, well, if I do this, it benefits this one. If I do that, right? And that's what he's talking about. Those lobbyists, I think they're in for a rude awakening.
Now, it was at this point in our conversation that Diana's tone shifted, and she said this isn't just politics for her. It's personal. And why? Well, she started by talking about the cost of her own health insurance.
I mean, I almost want to cry.
Because of the cost of your insurance?
I canceled my insurance. I had to because I can't afford it. I'm also supporting my father. Why? Because he only gets $1,800 a month for Social Security. His rent alone is $900, and his health care expenses are about $600. His co-pays went up. So one prescription a month that he gets went from $8 a month to $44, right? 2 years ago, my father took an overdose because he couldn't pay to live. He doesn't have enough money to live.
Your father had tried to take his own life.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, he's not a big drinker anymore. He doesn't drink. Bought like a bottle of scotch. Was on Dilaudid for a pain thing, which he shouldn't have been on, but that's a different story. Took 24 Dilaudid, washed it down with like 5 drinks of scotch, and went to bed. And luckily, because my father's so good with his routine, he put his oxygen on because he has COPD and he sleeps with it. And he wasn't thinking, you know, he's drunk, he's high, whatever. And then he woke up in the morning. And fortunately, I had called him and I'm a nurse and I'm listening to him. And
did he tell you why he did it?
He did tell me because he couldn't afford to live. And so that was one of my decisions to sell my house because I knew financially, I couldn't work, support him, do the house, do my business. And so when I see people, even on Facebook, saying, well, what about this person? What about that person? I'm thinking, well, what about me? It's a lot of money that I give my father every month from the sale of my house, which I'm almost out of. So this is personal, right? I mean, it is personal to have to do something like that. And I'm not looking for like a pat on the back. I'm not looking for martyrdom. I'll figure it out. But I want people to know that when do we start taking care of the people that are here? Like, I need to take care of my father. And so I'm trying to figure it out, right? So now I'm canceling my health insurance, and that money is going to go to help take care of my father. What else can I do? So I have to ask people who are listening, what about Diana's father, who has a name? His name is Richard. Doesn't his life matter? That's why I'm supporting Trump, because I really feel like, why doesn't Diana's life matter anymore? Why does somebody else's life matter more than mine or my father's?
Diana Ploss lives in Massachusetts and volunteered full-time for the Trump campaign.
Thanksgiving is just a week away, and that means turkeys on the minds of many people, where to buy one, what to do with it. And for many people, that means, how do you deep fry it? Deep frying can be dangerous and time-consuming and the cleanup a mess, but advocates swear by it. And the same can be said about frying chicken, and that's what we're about to talk about. There's a good deal of science to back this up as well. Stephanie Kuo from member station KERA in Dallas visits a few iconic North Texas chicken joints to break down the physics of the fry.
To get at the science of fried chicken, we're getting help from three players. There's the formerly trained chef who's dabbled in molecular gastronomy.
Omar Flores, chef owner of Whistle Birches.
There's the chef at Bibimbap Soul Kitchen, bringing Korean fried chicken to Dallas.
Sandra Bussey, I'm one of the chef and co-owners.
Then there's Kenji Lopez Alt, our science guy.
I'm the managing culinary director of Serious Eats, and I am the author of The Food Lab.
He'll be chiming in here and there to help us break down fried chicken to its basic elements. Step one. The thing everyone agrees on, the importance of brining. It involves soaking raw meat in a saltwater solution overnight. The brine at Whistle Britches mimics the flavor of a dill pickle.
A lot of fresh coriander, dill seed, there's mustard seed in there. We do garlic, we do rosemary, kind of real savory herbs. And I think it kind of really penetrates the chicken, and I think when you finally fry it, you end up with like a much kind of a juicier, kind of tender, aromatic product.
So why is that, science guy Kenji Lopez Alt?
The salt will actually break down a protein called myosin. And if you look at a piece of chicken or any meat really under a microscope, it really resembles sort of a bunch of cables that are kind of strung together and bound together. And each one of those little cables contains juices.
Then the heat from the frying forces those protein bundles to squeeze out moisture.
So when you brine something, all it does is it breaks down some of the muscles so that when you're cooking, it doesn't squeeze on those bundles. So a lot more of the juice ends up staying inside rather than getting squeezed out.
Step two, the batter. In the Whistle Britches kitchen in far north Dallas, Chef Omar Flores dips his chicken pieces into buttermilk and thickly coats them with seasoned flour.
And before it goes in the fryer, one real important thing is, I call it the clap. You know, so you take your pieces of chicken, and you kind of clap them together like that.
This is called dredging and battering. It's what gives fried chicken that crispy outer shell. Our science guy, Kenji Lopez Alt, says dredging isn't just for style or flavor.
We dredge because we want to create an insulating layer between the food and the oil. Oil is very, very hot. The brunt of that energy is being used to brown the batter, drive off moisture from the batter, and what actually gets into the chicken travels in much more slowly because batter is a good insulator.
And if batter is step two, then step three is the fry. What makes Korean fried chicken stand out is what's known as the twice fry. It starts at a relatively low temperature, and it goes low and slow.
The first time around, you're actually cooking the chicken through. The second time around, it's just to get that crust, and it's only a 2 to 3 minute burn.
It's kind of a flash fry. And the result?
And it is very, very crispy. I mean, if you're looking for a crispy chicken, you should try the Korean fried version because it's almost like a glass crackle texture to it.
Whether you twice fry like at Bibimbap or fry in a pressure cooker, as Omar Flores does at Whistle Britches, the science is pretty much the same. This sounds like Kenji Lopez Alt territory.
So when you're deep frying, the main process that's going on is dehydration. You're driving off water content, and that's what's going to, you know, allow your food to stay crispy once it gets crisp.
Scientifically, there are a couple of different things happening during the fry. There's expansion. The heat from the fryer causes air bubbles in the batter to stretch, the same way a ball of dough puffs up in the oven. The expansion thins out the batter and gives it that crunch. Then comes something called protein coagulation, which is just fancy science talk for the batter turning solid. All the while, oil gets absorbed into the meat, which helps give the chicken juice and flavor. The real magic comes at the end of the fry. browning and caramelization in a chemical process known as the Maillard reaction.
Essentially, what you're doing is you're breaking up the larger protein chains into smaller pieces. Those smaller pieces are then reacting with each other, forming larger proteins again, breaking down again. And what you end up with is hundreds of new chemical compounds that weren't present in the food at the beginning.
You can taste that magic on the char of a grilled steak or the crunch of a fried chicken. Our science guy, Kenji Lopez-Alt, says it all gets at something fundamental.
We have evolved to crave fat and salt and starch because these are all concentrated calorie sources. It's basically just, you know, hitting all the sort of primal pleasure centers of our brain.
Whether you're at Whistle Britches or BB Bop Soul Kitchen or the countless other chicken joints across North Texas, the science is constant. The recipes are chemistry, physics, and thermodynamics. But our love for fried chicken is basic biology.
Stephanie Kuo from member station KERA in Dallas. And it all made sense, Meghna, but I just can't imagine somebody glancing down at their fried chicken and saying, wow, look at that Maillard reaction.
Or the sweet taste of combustion done right.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.